construct things. They start, for instance, Tarquinius Priscus starts building a massive temple to Jupiter on the Capitoline Hill, which will become the national temple of the national god of the Romans. So he's the one who starts this project, a big, big temple to the national god of the Romans. And he also initiates a variety of other building programs. We hear from Livy that the people grumbled at this because they were forced to labor in peacetime as hard as they had to labor in wartime. Anyhow, Tarquinius Priscus, whatever the shady details of his reign, basically is presented to us as a more sophisticated sort of king, a king involved more in the construction and consolidation of the city of Rome. He is followed by Servius Tullius, a man of obscure origins. His name would suggest that he had some slave backgrounds. The Latin word for slave is servus, servant. And there is a tradition that he was the son of a slave woman. But he became king following Tarquinius Priscus, and he is presented to us as a social and military reformer. Basically, out of the reign of Servius Tullius in the Roman tradition came all of Rome's social and military institutions. Like that, they're all invented in the space of about 40 years by one guy. Maybe we're starting to get a bit of a picture of how the kings operate in Roman tradition. Servius Tullius dies a bad death in a coup d'etat and is replaced by Tarquinius Superbus, who is the son of Tarquinius Priscus, who has been waiting in the wings for many years, and takes over the throne. And basically, as his name supplies, Tarquinius, Tarquin the Arrogant, he behaves as a tyrant. He increases yet further the toil placed upon the Romans by building even bigger and more grandiose projects. He behaves in an arrogant fashion. He arbitrarily issues judgments against people. He executes senators who are in disagreement with him. Basically, he behaves as any tyrant in the ancient classical tradition behaves. He's in many ways a typical tyrant. And as a result of his behavior and the behavior of his son, as we'll see in the next lecture, he is ousted and thrown out of Rome. And as a result, the regal period comes to an end and is replaced with the Republic. But more of that later. So there are your seven kings then. And it's worth asking, how do we know any of this? And how did the Romans know any of it? Well, as I say, our chief source is Livy. And he had available to him earlier writers that are not available to us. But I must stress, all of the earlier writers that he had available to him were far later than the regal period. There were no extant literary sources available to Livy that were contemporary with the regal period. That's an important point. What else did he use? Well, he would have used the established legends, the communal legends and stories of the Romans. What the Romans told about their regal past, about their monarchic past. General communal legends. There would have been some archival and epigraphic material as well. For instance, we know that the pontifices, the pontiffs at Rome, kept records of signs and omens and prodigies from the gods. These were kept in the pontifical archive and appeared to have had attached to them notices of major historical events year by year. In the year that these signs were seen, when this and this and this happened, and so forth. And so as a result, it's possible that Livy would have had access to those pontifical archives. But again, how far back they went, what they were like, we have none of them. We can't read them. How far back they went, what they were like, and how reliable they were, that's a different issue. There may also have been some epigraphic material, some inscriptions from early Rome, which Livy could have looked at. Again, its quantity and its value are very hard to assess because we don't have much of it. We only have one little stone, in fact, a scrap of pottery as well, with some inscription on it. But how extensive and detailed and informative this was, we can't say. And the final form of a source that Livy would have had available to him would have been family histories, the histories of the individual aristocratic houses of Rome, who, as we'll see when we look at the Roman family, revered their ancestors. And Livy could have discussed the family histories with the individuals of his day and perhaps got information about the distant past. But again, the quality of that information we cannot check. We have available to us, unlike Livy, the material of archaeology, as well as comparative data from other early so-called archaic societies that allow us to at least see how typical or atypical the Roman kings were in relation to how we know other early societies ran their kingships. So you put it all together and we can at least check out these stories, and that's what we're going to do in just a minute. We're going to see how scholars assess the historicity, the truth, or lack of truth in these tales. Before I do that, however, there are some general characteristics of Roman kingship that are clear from these traditions that we should note, for they're interesting and we'll be seeing them again in the future. They will rear themselves in various shapes in the future of this course. First of all, the kings of Rome are not a family tree. It's not a dynasty that passed on from father to son. Kingship is not a hereditary quality in Rome. What happens is, at the end of a king's reign, a body of a council of noblemen, who the Romans called senators, came together and chose one of their number out from among their number, and then an election took place, and a new king was ratified by a vote of the people. If this process went on for a long period, a man called an interrex — the Latin for a king is rex, so an interrex means a man between a king, just an example of how logical and structured the Latin language is — so the man between the king came forward and he helped organize the elections and took the nominations and so forth to choose the next king. So that's an important point. The kingship of ancient Rome was not a hereditary institution. It was one that was rather passed around among a landowning aristocracy. And finally, the kings themselves, like most ancient kings, seem to have held authority over three areas. They were the chief military leaders of the state. In times of war, they're the ones who led the armies, made treaties, and decided on tactics and strategies and so forth. They were also the chief judicial body of the state. They're the ones who issued judgments. In the case of the likes of Tarquin, they were arbitrary and tyrannical judgments, but they are basically the font of law at this stage. And finally, they are the chief bridge between humans and gods. They are the chief religious authorities of the state. So the military, judicial, and religious branches of society are all controlled by kings. This is something, again, that has parallels in other cultures. Well, how true are these tales? How reliable are any of these stories? Save for the most extreme skeptic, there are no mainstream scholars who doubt the overall veracity of the regal period. There are no scholars who doubt that the period of the kings actually took place. In the first place, the Roman authors are absolutely unanimous that they were originally ruled by kings. There's not a single dissenting voice that says, oh no, we were never ruled by kings, we started off as a republic. Everyone agreed that there was a period when Rome was ruled by kings. Secondly, our earliest Latin stone inscription, which is to be found in the Roman Forum and can be seen today, our earliest extant stone inscription in Latin, written in quasi-Greek letters, but written in the Latin language, which is called the Black Stone, dates to about the 6th century BC. It's fragmentary, we can't read it. I mean, it might as well be a recipe for scrambled eggs, for all we know. But if it is a recipe for scrambled eggs, it's the recipes for a king's scrambled eggs, because the word king, rex, appears in the inscription, which is, I think, very interesting. Secondly, an even more dramatic piece of evidence, epigraphic evidence, became unearthed when excavations took place in the area known as the Regia in the Roman Forum. The Regia means the king's house. This was traditionally the place where the king lived. Excavations took place there in this century, and they dug down and they found very early buildings. Buildings going back as early as the 6th century BC. And in amongst the finds was a scrap of pottery. And the pottery is called Bucoro. It's a type of Etruscan pottery. And written on that pottery is one word. Rex, king. So extremely dramatic evidence found inside the king's house, written on an Etruscan piece of pottery in the 6th century BC, is the word king. And as I say, comparative data with other sources would seem to suggest that this model of kingship, as it's come down to us in the traditions from ancient Rome, isn't something in and of itself that we would question. From the Greeks and the Etruscans, we do see early contemporary societies at this time ruled by kings who then move away from kingship into a form of oligarchy, just as a Roman state was to do at the end of the regal period. So then, broadly speaking, most scholars would be agreed when you put all this evidence together. And it's not unproblematic evidence. A lot of it can be questioned. Some people argue, for instance, that the Rex of the inscriptions that I've just mentioned is not the king, but a man called Rex Sacrorum, a king of sacred rites who we know existed in the post-regal period, in the Republic. So all of it can be open to question, but you put it all together, and most scholars would be agreed that there was a monarchic regal period of Roman history. It's the details that are problematic. Were there seven kings? Well, the fact that the number of kings of Rome is seven is itself worrisome. Seven is one of those magical, special numbers in the Mediterranean culture. Seven and three, these are two numbers that have a special significance. Seven kings, it seems too neat. The regal period, by tradition, stretches from 753 to 509 BC. If we count inclusively, that's 245 years. Seven kings ruling over 245 years gives an average of 35 years per king. That is a longer average per reign than any historically documented dynasty anywhere. Even some of the most stable, such as the dynasty that is still in control in England. Okay, 35 years is exceptionally long. So that is cause for concern. And scholars looking at that fact come to either of two conclusions. And they're fairly logical. Either there were more kings who have dropped out of the picture, so to reach the number seven, that special number, or there were 70 kings, but the regal period is shorter. It wasn't 245 years. Both sides have been argued and can be argued cogently. Secondly, looking at the kings themselves, the stories surrounding the kings read more like moral tales and etiological tales, there's a good word, etiological tales that describe the origins of things, than they do actual historical events. I'll give you an example. The story of Servius Tullius's removal from power goes something like this. Servius Tullius had a rather evil daughter, Tullia by name, who began an adulterous affair with the son of Tarquinius Priscus, i.e. Tarquin the Younger, who was later to become Tarquin the Arrogant. This villainous couple then murdered Servius and seized power for themselves. The purpose of the story is as much didactic as anything else. It's a model of bad behavior for the Romans. Tullia is a person who is thoroughly evil. She carries out appalling and atrocious acts in the Roman eyes. She cheats on her husband, disrespecting the family institution. She murders people, and she disrespects her father, which is, by Roman standards, one of the worst things that you can do. She so disrespects him, in fact, says Livy, that she runs over his body in a chariot as it's lying on the street. Oh, and says Livy, this happens to be the same street that today is called Criminal Street as a result of that act. So what we seem to have then in the stories about the kings are really moral tales, nice stories that offer up examples of honourable and dishonourable behaviour and as well help explain the origins of things. I've mentioned just the issue of the street, but if we look at the broader functions of the kings themselves, there's definitely some cause for concern there. Think about it. All the kings seem to have specific agendas. Tullus Hostilius is the aggressive Tullius who goes out and beats up on Rome's Latin neighbours. Numa Pompilius is the guy who invents all of Rome's religious institutions, essentially, establishing all of the colleges of priests and most of the main cults of ancient Rome. Servius Tullius constructs Rome's social and military institutions. And so, in some ways, then, the kings appear to be like pegs. They appear to be pegs upon which later Romans would hang the origins of things. Said, oh, where did the priesthood called the Salius or the Salii come from? Where did they? Oh, Numa Pompilius, he was the religious king. He must have invented them. Oh, how is it that we have a system of centuries into which our army is organized? Oh, well, Servius Tullius was the social and military reformer. That must have been where that came from. In other words, the kings are sort of like pigeonholes into which the Romans, later Romans, could put the origins of various institutions and aspects of later Roman history and later Roman society. The names of the kings themselves are suspicious. Numa Pompilius. Pompilius seems to be related to the Latin word pompa, which means a religious procession. Here he is, Numa, the religious procession guy, and he's involved in establishing Rome's religious institutions. We have Tullus Hostilius, hostile Tullus, Tullus the aggressive, and he's a warmonger. We have Tarquinius Priscus, the first Tarquin, which seems to assume that there will be a second Tarquin. As far as archaeological evidence goes, we do have bits and pieces of early Rome. The situation with regard to the archaeology of early Rome is very difficult. Of course, Rome has always been occupied. You can't just go and plough up all the later imperial and republican city and try to get back to the earliest levels of the city. But bits and pieces of it have been found. And we do have some monuments from the very earliest period, including a sewer, the Cloaca Maxima, the great sewer of Rome, which is still in use and can be seen today. I'm showing you a photograph of it that I took recently on the River Tiber, and you can actually go down and take an even closer photograph of it. Much of what you see, if you go there today, is a 4th century reconstruction of the cloaca, but if you go inside, which I did not do, but people have actually ventured inside, then you can see the original 6th century masonry inside. It's still in use. So there are signs then that Rome in this early period, around 600 BC or thereabouts, 600 say to 500 BC, is undergoing quite a lot of urban development, and this would be consistent with a monarchic type rule, especially an Etruscan monarchic type rule, which raises the question about the Etruscans. Naturally, those people who see an Etruscan period of Roman history are the same ones who believe in a wider Etruscan dominance in central Italy at this time. According to this view, the Tarquinian dynasty, the two Tarquins, represent the takeover of Rome by Etruscans. In other words, the foreign occupation of the city by the Etruscans. We do find Etruscan pottery, as I've said, in Rome. We also find Etruscan-style statuary in some of the earliest levels of Rome, made out of clay and very much in the Etruscan style. Of course, the Romans had a tradition themselves that the Tarquins came from Etruria. So, according to this model then, clear evidence of the Etruscan period of Roman history. Well, as I've mentioned, the wider Etruscan control of central Italy has been called into question, and if that's called into question, then the Etruscan period of Rome likewise must be called into question. What's the nature of the control of the Tarquins over Rome? Well, the tradition is clear that Tarquinius Priscus, formerly called Lucumo, came from the town of Tarquinii, but came with his wife. He didn't come with an army. He came with his wife, moved into the community of Rome, and made himself a man of importance through his wealth and charm and aggressive canvassing for his own position, and eventually became king through the process of election. This seems to be more in line with what we know generally about archaic societies in which aristocratic people can move between communities with relative degrees of freedom. The connections between aristocrats in these early societies, the personal connections between them, seems to have been more important than their individual citizenship. And so, on the model of the looser Etruscan control of Rome, what we have is evidence in the archaeology for Etruscan cultural influence in the city, absolutely, and evidence as well that an Etruscan family became dominant at some stage and was remembered as having become dominant, perhaps, but that we're not talking about the occupation of Rome by a foreign power. We're not talking about the Etruscans conquering the city of Rome, but rather an Etruscan family rising to prominence from the community of Rome, having come in from outside. Again, whether that view is going to be very widely accepted is still to be seen. So much then for the regal period and the stories of the kings. Much of what I've told you is hotly debated. I've tried to outline at least the main thrusts of the scholarly debates that are ongoing about this subject. But fundamentally, the issue of what you believe or don't believe about this period boils down to a simple question. How much do you believe the written sources? Some scholars like to believe that the written sources are certainly legendary and do not tell a straightforward historical fact. But they like to say instead they must reflect something of an historical past. They must reflect something, some communal memory of these kings and so forth and their reigns. It's a matter of degree. How much are you going to accept them? Some scholars say all the legends are complete nonsense and have nothing to do with history. We should only look at the archaeology. Forget the written legends and stories. Nice that they might be, they're not historical. So it's really a matter of degree. One has to orient oneself on a spectrum of opinion. And you can only do that, and I urge everyone to do so, by reading lots of Livy and lots of modern scholarship on the subject. Next time we will look at the society, at least as far as we can reconstruct it, the society of this earliest period of Roman history.
Lecture 6, Regal Society.
Hello again, and welcome to the 6th lecture in the History of Ancient Rome. The last time we looked at the traditions concerning the kings of Rome, 7 in number, according to the stories, and we also examined the question, difficult and hotly debated question, of how believable, how historical those various traditions and stories about the kings are. I'll leave the final decision on that difficult issue to you all individually. And I want to move on today to examine the shape of this early Roman society. There are many features of later Roman society that the Romans themselves considered to be very old, very ancient, and which most scholars would accept were in fact very old and may go back to this very earliest phase of Roman history, may go back to the regal period. And that's what I want to focus on today. I want to look first of all at the general shape of Roman society, which we'll see was typically archaic, that is to say typical for a period of around 600, 500 BC or so. Then we will look at some of the peculiar institutions, some of the peculiar aspects, facets of Roman society that were really unique in many ways to the Romans themselves. Then we look at the broad shape of politics as it seems to have been played out at this early period. And we'll end by taking an example, the so-called Servian constitution, or Servian reforms, which we'll use as an example to show the difficulties of trying to interpret the data as we have it for this early period of Roman society. The regal society of Rome, so far as we can reconstruct it again, was typically archaic. It was dominated by aristocratic landowners. There seems to have been, from the start, a division between free and slave. It does seem that the Romans were a slaving society from very early on, as were, well, most societies, as we'll see when we come to look at the depressing question of slavery in ancient Rome. It's unfortunately the case that most societies in human history have been slaving societies. But they don't seem to have been particularly numerous, the slaves in this very early period of ancient Rome. But there was a division between free and, or at least freeborn, and slave. And that's the most basic division that seems to have existed in this early society. Within the freeborn population, there was a division, a distinction between the citizen and the non-citizen. Now, throughout this entire course, when I say citizen, I'll be referring to the adult male population of Rome, who were enfranchised, who were allowed the vote, and were allowed to take part in the political process, and had various judicial and legal rights that non-citizens did not possess. Again, the citizen body of ancient Rome was always a restricted body of adult male citizens. Excluded were all women, obviously slaves, and any foreigners who had come to Rome and were not members of the citizen body, i.e., I suppose alien residents is what they'd be called, or resident aliens would be what they'd be called today. This citizen body appears from earliest times to have been divided into units called tribes. Again, this terminology is quite difficult. I'm not referring to the tribal societies that I talked about when we looked at pre-Roman Italy, the non-urbanized tribal societies like, say, the Samnites in central Italy. Rather, these units are called tribes because the Latin word is tribus, which means it appears to be derived from the word three. It appears to be by threes. And this would make sense since we hear that the Roman citizen body was initially divided into three units called tribes. These seem to have been voting units, units that were used for the constitution of a popular assembly for the purposes of voting. So they're called tribes. I know that the terminology is a wee bit confusing since we've looked at tribal societies, but that's not what I'm talking about here. When I talk about the citizen tribes or the voting tribes, I'm talking about these divisions of citizens into voting units. So there were originally three of these tribes, it seems, from the very earliest times. One of the chief duties of citizenship that fell upon all citizens was military service. If you had privileges as a citizen, you also had obligations. And those obligations in all archaic societies, high up on the list, is military service. If the call to arms comes, you collect your equipment, because you're not supplied by the state, and you show up on the appointed day, enroll in the army, and go off and fight whoever it is. If you happen to be a citizen living under Tullus Hostilius, it seems, then you spent quite a lot of your summer time out in the fields beating up on your neighbours. It seems that the Romans at this early stage, this is a point that we come back to, but it seems that the Romans at this very early stage fought in the formation called the phalanx, which is a Greek-style, tightly packed body of heavily armoured soldiers with large round shields and using spears predominantly as an offensive weapon. The idea of the phalanx is to advance upon your enemy in a single mass and quite literally shove them off the field. It's when the opposing army breaks that most of the killing is done. There's a period of shoving, and then when the other line breaks, then you do a lot of the killing. But more of that when we come to look at Roman warfare and the Roman army. Other archaic societies, particularly those that are better documented, like in Greece, it seems that the land-owning, wealthy families dominated this early society. These families, and all the common families as well, were grouped into units called, well, we call them clans. The Latin word is gens, plural gentes, and they've been translated into English as clans. These are very, very unclear units for us today, but it's very hard to us to appreciate where this idea came from. We know that the clans were often organized around a particular religious shrine. It may have originally been a religious grouping at its soul, but it's really very hard to make out where this organization came from. And when we talk about a clan, we're talking about a group of families who share, as we'll see, who share a name and are identified as members of X or Y clan. So the origins of this clan system then, most obscure, its exact function is most obscure, but it seems that all Roman citizen bodies were members of clans. Some of them prominent, some of them less prominent. I mentioned to you the issue of the Roman name, and it's worth bringing that into play now, because the Roman name reflects the dominance of the clan system. Traditionally, your typical Roman citizen would have three names. I'll pick an example, Lucius Cornelius Sulla would be a typical Roman name. But the name actually is more than just an identification like Joe Smith or Joe Bloggs or Helen Schaefer or whatever. The name actually identifies you in the social cosmos. It locates you in the Roman hierarchical social order. The most important name of the three names of the Roman is the middle one. It's just called the name, sometimes called the clan name. This is the name, so in the case of Lucius Cornelius Sulla, that's named Cornelius. That tells you that this person is a member of the Cornelian clan. That's a prominent clan. That's an important clan. You know immediately hearing that name, this is a person of importance. The name in front of the main name is called the praenomen, which means the name in front. And that is the name that identifies you as an individual. Lucius. So with Lucius Cornelius, we get the information you are the individual Lucius of the clan Cornelius. The Romans, by the way, had very few of these four names. So few, in fact, that they're often abbreviated, as they are in your booklets, by single letters. Lucius, for instance, is L. Titus is T. Marcus is M. Quintus is Q, and so forth. So there were actually very few of those names. They weren't particularly imaginative when it came to naming people, at least naming individuals. So the praenomen, though, is the name that indicates your individual identity within the clan. And the third name seems originally to have been a nickname that was added on to certain branches of a clan and so was generally identified as a family name. So you have Lucius Cornelius Sulla is Lucius from the clan Cornelius of the family Sulla that's in the clan Cornelius. Okay? Because you could also have another guy, say, called Publius Cornelius Scipio. Well, he's the individual Publius in the same clan Cornelius, but of the family Scipio. Different family, same clan. But the point that I'm driving home here is that it's the clan name. That's the key one. That's the one that's called the name. Okay? And the other two names are in reference to it. One of the features of Roman society from this early period that was to live on throughout Roman history is a rather odd feature of Roman society, is the system called clientship. Clientela in the Latin. Clientship. Now, when I explain this to my students, I like to draw on an image from modern movies to explain how clientship works. Basically, clientship is a system of favor granting which results in an obligation being placed upon the person to whom the favor has been granted. I'll scratch your back if you scratch mine. That is the fundamental nature of it. It's a system of reciprocal arrangements between people. And the image that I always like to give my students is the opening scene of The Godfather. We have Don Corleone sitting passively in his study with various cap-ringing lollies brought before him to ask favors, and he either imperiously grants or denies the requests. If he grants the request, they're then under an obligation to him. From that, okay, it's a criminal obligation. I'm not saying that ancient clientship was one big mafia organization, but the essence of that relationship that's being expressed in The Godfather is really what clientship is about. You go to someone who has influence or power to help you. You ask them for a favor. That's the literal Latin word, beneficium, a benefit, a favor. And then once that is done, you are under an obligatio, an obligation to them, to support them. Or do whatever it is that they might want you to do. It might be political support. It might be to help build a barn on the farm, whatever. When the time comes for you to pay back the favor, you do it. You become the client of a patron. The person granting the favor is a patron. The person accepting the favor, now under the obligation, is the client. Clientela, clientship, helped offset the horizontal stratification in Roman society. It created vertical connections between prominent and lowly families. And so the centrifugal forces that might threaten to tear a really hierarchical society apart were somewhat offset by this system of favor granting. I should point out that inherent in the system is the expectation that the client has something to offer. You don't grant a favor to someone who can do nothing for you in return. So as a result, the poorest and destitute members of society will tend to be left out of this system. Not everyone was involved in a patron-client relationship. In many ways, it's a relationship between parties of relative degrees of influence. More influence, granting help to people of lesser influence that can then be utilized if the people with more influence need it in the future. Another feature of Roman society that appears to have gone back to the very earliest periods is the organization of people into groups called orders. Orders. By orders, I'm using the phrase in the Latin term ordo, plural ordines, which means a rank, a status, a rank within a society. And by tradition, there were two orders in the very earliest periods of Roman history, the patricians and the plebeians. Most scholars are of the opinion that the plebeians didn't actually come into existence as an order until later. And we look, in fact, at the possible emergence of the plebeians in the later lecture. But it does seem that the patricians are very old indeed, and may indeed go back to the earliest periods, back to the regal period of Roman history. The patricians were a group of clans defined by birth. In other words, your patrician status came with you with your name. It was identifiable with your name, immediately. For instance, the Cornelii were all patricians. So any member of the clan Cornelius was automatically a patrician. So was the clan Julius, for instance. Or the clan Claudius. Claudius was also a patrician name. And other names would be automatically recognized as being non-patrician, later designated as plebeian. Well, goodness, the question, where did the system of patricians come from, is, you won't be surprised to hear, hotly debated. Various theories have been advanced over the years. sometimes theories that reflect more the interests or inclinations of those advancing them than they do anything about the past. For instance, when racial theories of superiority were popular, well, what do we have? The patricians are obviously of decent, Aryan, hard-working stock, and the slovenly plebeians are your typical Mediterranean shiftless types. Yeah. Absolute nonsense, not a single shred of evidence to support any racial distinction between the patricians and the plebeians. Other views have been, for instance, that the patricians were all the wealthy clans, and the plebeians were the poor. In other words, that there's an economic division. But that seems to be overly simplistic, and there's evidence for wealthy plebeian clans from early on in the history of the Republic, and so if the plebeians were around before that, the argument goes, it's unlikely that they just suddenly became wealthy out of nowhere. So the economic division between patricians and plebeians seems to be a bit simplistic and a bit naive. Whatever the case of the origin of these orders, it does seem that the patricians were around from the very earliest periods, and I reiterate, the plebeians, who later are designated as everyone who's not a patrician. That's a later designation. The origin of the plebeians, whether or not they were around early, as early as the patricians, that's a matter of considerable debate and is unclear to us. Personally, I favour the view that the plebeians emerged slightly later in the early Republic. But this we will look at when we examine the so-called struggle of the orders between the plebeians and the patricians in the early and middle Republic. So, what we have then, if we just pause to look at this sort of shape of Roman society before we examine the system of politics, what we have in early Roman society is already a fairly hierarchical system, social order. And this will be a mark of Roman society throughout its entire history. It was a rigidly hierarchical social order where status determined everything. If you were a patrician, you had advantages over non-patricians. If you were a citizen, you had advantages over a non-citizen. If you were freeborn, you had advantages over slaves. We're dealing with a social order that's rigidly hierarchic, and was to become even more so, but which is somewhat offset by the system of clientship between people of influence. Looking at the politics of the regal period, what we see is that, as we've seen already, the kings were chosen from among the Senate body and were granted their powers by ratification by popular vote. The Senate at this early stage is also much disputed. Was it a standing body in the state? Was it an ad hoc advisory council to the king convened as needed? Or did it meet regularly, twice a month, say? Most unclear as to whether or not the Senate was a regular standing body of the state. But certainly from its ranks were chosen the next candidates for the kingship, and the vote was taken by the people, who were into a popular committee, a popular assembly, known as the Comitia Curiata, which means the Curiate Assembly. This is because they were organized into 30 units called Curiae. What's Curia mean? We don't know. We wish we did. It just means a grouping, so far as we can tell. Curia, it's curious, there's no pun intended. Okay, there was. The Comitia Curiata then is literally the meeting of the people in their curiae, and there were 30 of them, as seemed to have been the case, 10 curiae per tribe. So you had three tribes originally, and then the tribes were subdivided into 10 units each called curiae, and when the vote came, the vote was taken by blocks, block voting. It was the curiae that voted, not the individuals. The individuals voted within their particular curia, but then it was the curial vote that was put forward. That's why it's called the curiate assembly, the assembly of people organized into voting units called curia. The origins of this, again, are most unclear, but we have parallels for it in Greece and in other archaic societies. Even in some fairly rigid and monarchic societies, popular assemblies seem to have been a feature of these early archaic societies, so it's not surprising to find one in Rome. So the Comitia Curiata is the earliest of the popular assemblies. When we look at the Republic, we'll see that three more came to be added to that list. Yes, that's three more popular assemblies, but more of that anon. It's important as well to note that the main function of the Curiate Assembly is to ratify the choice of king, and then to confer upon that king the power of command. This power is called imperium in Latin. And we'll be seeing a lot more of this. Pay careful attention to this concept. Imperium is the quality of command. It allows you, basically, to order people around. It's got a very military feel to it. A general, for instance, in Latin is called an imperator, a man who wields imperium, a man who wields the power of command. And note that in the Roman tradition, it's the people who confer imperium. The people, the populus Romanus, convened into an official assembly, are the only ones who can confer the power of command upon someone. That's the main function of the curiate assembly. Ratify the Senate's choice of king and confer the power of command upon that king. By the way, as an aside, the word imperium might look vaguely familiar. It means the power of command. Then it came to mean the area over which the Romans had the power to command people. And so it's come into the English language as empire. And that's why we have empire and imperial, as opposed to imperial. Anyhow, that's an aside, a linguistic aside. Some of the difficulties of trying to sort out the social, political and military details of this earlier period are nicely illustrated, I believe, by consideration of what's called the Servian Constitution or the Servian Reforms. We saw in the last lecture how the King Servius Tullius was accredited in the tradition with basically inventing Rome's social and military system. Well, when Livy and another source that was contemporary with Livy, a man called Dionysius of Halicarnassus, he wrote in Greek, but he wrote about Roman antiquities in Greek, and was a contemporary of Livy, so he's writing at about the same time or so, these two gentlemen described the Servian constitution. In other words, they ascribed this to Servius Tullius, the king who came between the two Tarquins. What they say is as follows. They say that Servius Tullius came around and instituted a wide-ranging series of reforms. He disposed of the three original tribes of Roman people, which seem to have or may have been organized along ethnic lines. Remember, we saw that the very earliest fledgling state of Rome had adopted many Sabines into its midst, and some scholars believe that this is the origin of the tribes, to divide the original units of Roman society out from each other ethnically. Well, whatever the case about that, the three original tribes, they're often called the Romulian tribes, the tribes established by Romulus, were replaced by Servius Tullius, we are told, by 20 tribes, now determined by location. In other words, the tribes are like parishes or boroughs, and one enters a tribe by being born into a certain location, living in a certain location. So these are essentially local units, and we are told he had four urban tribes, four that were based in the city, and 16 that were based in the countryside. Fair enough. We're also told by Livy and Dionysius that Servius then instituted a system of classes based upon wealth. He divided the Roman citizen body. Remember, all this applies now to adult males only. He divided the citizen body into five classes based upon their wealth. These classes he then organized into units called centuries, which were a military organization, according to our sources. They were units in the army. So you would have had soldiers, according to this reconstruction, you would have had soldiers divided up by wealth, equipped differently, depending on how they could actually afford to equip themselves. Finally, he used this military organization as the basis to create a new popular assembly, which was called the Comitia Centuriata, the Centuriate Assembly. The people assembled in centuries. We have the curiate assembly on one hand, the people assembled in their curiae. Now we have a new series of voting blocks, the people assembled in centuries. And according to our traditions, these centuries were assigned to the different classes in such a way that the richer classes had an advantage. Remember, the voting is done in the blocks, in the voting blocks of centuries, not by individual. So if you have more centuries assigned to the numerically fewer richer people, they'll have a greater advantage in the voting in that assembly. So in other words, this is a complex situation. We have Servius Tullius instituting new tribes, a new military order and then using that military order as the basis for a new political order. All of this is supposed to have come out of the head of Servius Tullius in the mid-6th century BC. It can be shown that this is impossible. It can be shown from the evidence of Dio, of Dionysius and Livy themselves. In the year 495 BC, these same authors who have reported the Servian constitution tell us that in 495 BC, two new tribes were added because of the expansion of Roman territory, bringing the total, they tell us, to 21. Hang on a minute. I thought Servius Tullius had introduced 20 tribes. If the total reached 21 in 495 BC, where's that missing tribe? The answer is undoubtedly that this latter picture is the more correct one. That the number of local tribes grew piecemeal, incrementally, in pace with the expansion of Roman territory. It makes sense. The idea that they just came out of Servius Tullius's head is much more unlikely. And we can say, for instance, that some of the names of the tribes, even the ones that are supposed to have been created by Servius Tullius, are anachronistic. For instance, one tribe is called Tribe Claudia, clearly named after the influential patrician clan, the Claudii. But those guys didn't come to Rome till 504 BC, 50 years or more after Servius Tullius. So it can be shown, then, that these details are questionable, that the ancient sources have simplified a more complex evolutionary process and ascribed it all, pigeonholed it, under Servius Tullius. What's more, the division of the people into five classes is very difficult, because especially five classes of centuries to fight in the army. The Romans at this stage fought in, as I've said, in the phalanx formation. What you need is a large round shield, a spear, breastplate, helmet, and a sword. If you can afford it, a piece of armour for your lower leg called a greave, which covers your knee down, the shield covering your thigh. Okay? You can't go in sort of missing the shield into a phalanx. It isn't as if you can say, listen, I can afford most of the equipment, but I can't afford the spear. I can still push up my shield. Or I can headbutt the guy or whatever. Or I can't afford a helmet. In other words, the division of people into five classes assumes a more complex military situation than the phalanx would seem to allow. Specifically, since this division is accredited in our sources as being instituted for military purposes originally. Surely the only division is between those who can afford the equipment and those who can't. Why aren't there just two classes? Maybe that's what Servius Tullius did originally. He made a classification of people into those who can afford it, for the equipment, and those who can't. But this later division into five classes reflects a more complex military order, which we know the Romans instituted towards the end of the 5th century. At this point, they divided their troops into units called maniples. Okay? And they began to operate in a more tactically complex fashion on the battlefield, with a grade of equipment involved. The five classes of soldier much better fit that picture, i.e. a late 5th century BC development, than they do a mid-6th century BC development. Again, what we seem to have in our sources is a conflation of a more complex evolutionary process packed in together into one single unit and presented to us as the product of a single man operating in a single brief period. This then is the broad shape of Roman society. We will be seeing again the Comitia Centuriata when we look at the Republic. And it is, in fact, to the establishment of the Republic that I will turn our attention the next time round. I hope, though, that some of the difficulties of trying to interpret the data for the regal period have been made clear to you. You can see how it is that our sources are often contradictory and how, once more, at the heart of everything in trying to analyse all this data is the issue of interpretation and argument and the presentation of contrary and competing reconstructions of events. That is the heart of ancient history, as I said in lecture one, and I hope by now everyone has got that message loud and clear.
Lecture 7, The Beginnings of the Republic.
Well, Welcome once more to the History of Ancient Rome. We are continuing in our examination of early Roman history, and we're going to move away today from the regal period, which has occupied our attention for the previous two lectures, and look at the foundation of the Republic. The Roman Republic, established by tradition in 509 BC, which continued as a form of government down to 31 BC, so a long period of existence by the Roman Republic. A very interesting and dynamic period of history. It'll be the framework for our lectures for quite a while yet. It's in this period that the Romans gained control over Italy. It's in this period that they gained control over the rest of the Mediterranean. And then towards the end of the Republic, we find a fascinating process of dissolution. It's awesome to watch this happen, the unraveling of so carefully a constructed system of government on the rocks of political ambition, a lack of consensus. But all of that is the subject for future lectures. What I want to do today is focus specifically on the foundation of the Republic, the transition from monarchy to republic. And first of all, we will look at the Roman traditions. As always, I believe they are the starting point, and we should always take them into account first and foremost. We look at the Roman traditions concerning the fall of the monarchy, the expulsion of the Tarquins from Rome in 509 BC. We'll see that, unsurprisingly, these turn out to be rather moralistic tales. They're very colourful, but nonetheless, the issue of their historicity will be discussed as well. And we'll see as well how, in the Roman tradition, the early Republic faced some immediate challenges, which it overcame by having in its midst all kinds of wonderful characters who had the right moral fibre to stand up against these challenges, meet them, and bring the Republic into a new dawn. We will also look at the shape of the early Republic in its broadest outlines. These, of course, again, remain matters of tremendous uncertainty, given our source material. But the broad outlines have been generally agreed upon by most scholars, at least the outlines of the system of government. And we'll end with a discussion of the emergence, possible emergence at this time, of the order of the plebs, of the plebeians, and set the stage thereby for a discussion of the struggle of the orders in the next lecture. In Roman tradition, the expulsion of the Tarquins, the end of monarchic government at Rome, was a very personal event. It centred around a single crime, which, if we believe the sources, so incensed the Roman aristocracy that they figured that they'd had enough not only of Tarquin, but of the whole institution of kingship, which had gone sour. The crime was committed on a woman of noble birth, Lucretia, the wife of a nobleman, Collatinus, who, with his young Turk friends, was out besieging a neighbouring city of the Romans one time. And at a drinking party with his friends, the issue arose as to the relative merits of their wives, as can happen at all male drinking parties. And various men began to boast about the qualities of their wives, and Collatinus especially praised the virtue of his wife Lucretia. They decided that the best way to see if this was true was to test it. So, drunk though they were, they got on their horses. I presume there was no regulations against drunk riding in those days. And they galloped back to Rome and visited each of the houses in turn, and of course found many of the wives involved in parties, which is what wives are not supposed to do when their husbands are besieging neighbouring towns. But when they went into Lucretia's house, there she was, spinning wool with her maids. One of the members of this party was none other than Sextus Tarquinius, the son of Tarquin the Arrogant. And we're told Sextus Tarquinius was overcome with an unnatural lust for the virtuous Lucretia. So at some later date, when Collatinus was away, Sextus comes back to the house of Lucretia, is invited to stay the night, and in the midst of the night enters her bedroom, threatens her with a sword, and rapes her. He says that if she says anything, he will murder a slave, and let it be known that she was raped by a slave, which he found, this act in progress, which he found and then killed the slave. He would present himself as a hero who would save Lucretia, but she would be forever humiliated for having been raped by a slave, herself and her family. When her father and husband came back, Lucretia, unable to hide this dreadful act, broke down in tears and revealed what had happened. And she was inconsolable, and try though they might, her menfolk could not make her see the fact that she was a victim. And to preserve her honour and the honour of her family, she committed suicide. One member of the group who found Lucretia, a friend of the family's, was named Lucius Junius Brutus, a man of the nobility, who was so incensed by this act, this final crime on the part of the Tarquin dynasty, that he helped rouse opinion against the Tarquins among the aristocracy, and they were thrown out of Rome. They were expelled. They weren't killed, but they were driven away. And the Republic was declared, with Brutus and Collatinus as the first annual magistrates of the Republic. That is the tale as we have it in our sources. It's a tale of personal transgression with political consequences. But the saga isn't over then. Tarquinius is out of Rome, but he's still alive. The first threat to the Republic is a plot from inside Rome to restore the monarchy. The plot's discovered, and the leaders of the plot executed. Tarquin himself, however, is outside Rome marshalling support among his friends in Tuscany, among the Etruscans originally, and he makes two attempts with Etruscan backing to retake the city by violence, and both attempts are defeated. The second attempt is the most threatening and is led by the king of the Etruscan town Clusium, a man with the glorious name Lars Porsena. He's an ally of Tarquin. This attempt, we're told, came very close to success, but ultimately failed. Tarquin, however, wasn't finished. He made one last attempt to rouse Rome's Latin subjects, or allies, against her, and attempted to seize control of Rome through rebellion among the Latins, but that finally failed at 499 BC at a crucial battle, Battle of Lake Regillus, and as a result, Tarquin gave up, retired to the Campanian town of Cumae, where he died in exile. So the story then is the expulsion of the Tarquins for reasons of personal crime, but then attempted retakings of the city. It's all very dramatic, all very heroic. And all throughout, the story is laced with wonderful romantic tales. Now, I'll take just one example, which certainly when I was a schoolboy, way back in the BC years, was required learning in English class. These were the Lays of Ancient Rome by Lord Macaulay, published in 1842, apparently no longer in print in and of themselves, which is a shame because they are tremendous, tremendous poems. But there's always an image that has stuck in my head ever since and is in fact derived from the tales of early Rome as written by Livy. That's the story of Horatius on the bridge. The story goes that in Tarquin's second attempt to take Rome with the backing of Lars Porsena, the Etruscan horde came over the hill and frightened the Roman force that was across the Tiber waiting for them to approach. And the force broke up in panic. The leader of that force, a man called Horatius Cocles, organized his men, rallied them, and said, "You go at the bridge." It was a wooden bridge. Remember the bridge built by Ancus Marcius, a wooden bridge over the Tiber. "You break up the bridge and I'll take care of the Etruscans." Yes, he single-handedly holds off the Etruscan army while his men behind hack at the bridge with their axes. Not only that, but he taunts the Etruscans as he's fighting them single-handedly away from the bridge. He mocks them and says they are merely the slaves of a tyrant who, with no liberty of their own, have come to rob others of their liberty. Mockingly hacking them down left and right. Livy has a wonderful expression in a surge of blood to the head. Livy, in a patriotic burst, describes Horatius as that great soldier whom the fortune of Rome gave to be her shield on that day of peril. Ooh, it's rousing stuff. You want to go out and beat up some Etruscans. Well, the bridge finally collapses behind Horatius, and he's left stranded facing his enemies. So what does he do? Jumps into the Tiber River fully armed and swims across, where he's met with tremendous hullabaloo, multiple honours are conferred upon him, and a public statue erected in his honour. So, what do we have? Well, we have more moral tales, don't we? We have tales of moral fibre. After all, Livy, in his introduction to his history, states unequivocally that the function of his description of Roman history is to present exemplar, models of behaviour, good and bad. His other main function is to trumpet the Roman achievement and the gloriousness of the Roman nation. He states that quite clearly at the beginning of Book 1, in his preface to his history. Here's why I'm doing this. I want to present examples. And in the cycle of tales around the exploits of the Tarquins, there are wonderful examples, both good and bad. We have Lucretia, the paradigm of womanly virtue. She's so concerned about her own honour and the honour of her family, and by her family I mean her family's menfolk and their name, that she commits suicide rather than face